This is your moment. Your moment to move forward and make progress. It's time to see where an education can take you. For over 130 years, Strayer University has been at the forefront of change, offering programs that help students like you get ahead and stay ahead, so you can keep striving. Visit strayer.edu to learn more. Strayer University is certified to operate in Virginia by CHEV.
You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Columbia.
It's that time of the week again, folks. This is me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Bogota, Colombia, 2,600 meters closer to the stars. And this is episode 365 of the Columbia Calling podcast. This week's very special guest will be back in segment three. It's Juan Jose Guzman, who will be on the line with us from New York. And we'll be talking about his, something he set up called Pacto por el Clima. He's the co-director of this organization promoting youth activism for climate change in Latin America. So quite exciting and quite positive at the end when we think about new generations coming through, something I talk about quite a lot, but new generations coming through, not only in Colombia, but in Latin America for worthy causes. And so I hope you'll stay tuned for this episode. It's really uplifting, as I said, to hear someone of this generation, of a younger generation, talking so positively about issues and campaigning so rigorously. This, as I said, is episode 365, and I just want to take a moment to thank the five new pledges on Patreon who've signed up to support the Columbia Calling podcast. That's Hannes, Amanda, Sergio, Larry, and Sean. Thank you, all of you, for signing up. And if you want to know how to do so, if you're not a Patreon and you want to become a Patreon and support the Columbia Calling podcast, that's patreon.com and look up Columbia Calling. And for as little as $2 a month, you can pledge to support the Patreon and the Columbia Calling podcast. And thank you as well to Daniel, who bought a Columbia Calling t-shirt on our bonfire.com page. So thank you to Daniel for that as well. Just check that out. There's hoodies, mugs, t-shirts, tote bags, all sorts of things on our bonfire.com page for those people who are looking for Columbia Calling merchandise. It's been interesting weeks, and numbers are dropping. Official numbers are dropping of coronavirus cases in Colombia, so this is only positive, as are, well, there are vaccines arriving. So it's not time for me to urinate on the government's parade. Vaccines are arriving and numbers are dropping. So this is positive. Hopefully this can reflect, for me at least, in terms of an upturn in tourism towards Mompox and, of course, all small towns around Colombia. So we'll be back. It's in segment three. That will be me talking to Juan Jose Guzman. I hope you enjoyed last week's show with Shauna Galuli talking about SOS Buenaventura. Very important show. And right now we'll be leaving you in the capable hands of Emily Hart with another news segment from her there in her base in Medellin. So thank you again, everyone who has committed to the Columbia Calling podcast and the campaigns that we are raising here to not only raise attention and awareness of what's going on in Colombia, but to ensure the survival of this small podcast by one guy and his desk in Colombia, in Bogota, and of course, Emily Hart there at her desk in Medellin. So thank you again, and don't go away.
I'm Emily Hart, and these are your top stories for the week of March 1st, 2021. The witness tampering case against former President Álvaro Uribe continues, while the star witness against him refuses to testify. The prosecutor leading the case against Álvaro Uribe has demanded that imprisoned ex-paramilitary leader Juan Guillermo Monsalve should testify, but Monsalve has refused, saying he fears an ambush or a trap by the prosecutor. Monsalve is the star witness in the case because it is alleged that he was the one whom Uribe, through third parties, tried to manipulate into changing a testimony which implicated the former president in the formation of paramilitary groups. Prosecutor Gabriel Jaimes must decide before the 8th of March whether to formally charge Uribe with witness tampering and bring him to trial or end the process. Most of the evidence Jaimes has requested aims to reinforce Uribe's arguments, and many are therefore speculating that he intends to close the case. The director of the United Nations Human Rights Office in Colombia has urged the government to dismantle paramilitary groups in order to secure peace. These armed groups and their associates are held responsible for much of the country's persistent violence. According to the UNHCR's annual report, 133 human rights defenders and community leaders were murdered in 2020, the highest number since the peace deal with former guerrilla group the FARC in 2016. The Human Rights Office additionally stressed that it had registered 76 massacres last year, the highest number since 2014, in which 292 people were killed. More than half of those massacres took place in three departments of Colombia: Antioquia, Cauca, and Nariño. The government has announced the capture of one of the heads of the Clan del Golfo, Colombia's biggest armed group. According to the national police, alias D-Max is considered to be a close ally of Otoniel, the top leader, and he was in charge of the cocaine shipment routes from Colombia's Urabá region to Central America and the United States. It has been estimated in a new report submitted to the Transitional Justice Tribunal, the HEP, that 8,000 children, those under the age of 18, were recruited by different armed actors between the years 1997 and 2000 alone. The case continues. During marches and protests commemorating Day Against Police Brutality, Gareth Stephen Sayer, a 24-year-old student, was shot in his left eye with a tear gas canister by a member of Colombia's ESMAD riot police. He lost vision in his eye. Vaccinations against coronavirus have finally begun in Colombia, and case numbers continue to fall, now at fewer than 4,000 new cases registered per day, down from a peak of 20,000 last month. Colombia has now seen 60,000 coronavirus deaths in a population of 50 million. That was this week's news. Now back to Colombia Calling with Richard McCall.
And we're back. This is Colombia Calling, episode 365. I'm Richard McCall here in Bogota, Colombia. My very special guest this week is Juan José Guzmán, who is in New York at the moment. And Juan José got in touch with the Colombia Calling podcast, offering his expertise and knowledge on a very, very interesting topic here for Colombia. So before we delve into that and environmental activism, let's just say, Juan José, welcome on the Colombia Calling podcast.
Hello, Richard. Thank you. Thank you very much for accepting this unsolicited request of being in your podcast and for, as we say in Colombia, pararme bolas.
No, it's an absolute pleasure to have you on it. And I love having Colombians on the podcast because sometimes Colombians are like, it's a foreign language podcast. It's not for us, but it is. It's for everyone. So it's always.
I listen to it. So I do think of it as being my own.
There we go. No, it's fun, you know, and we try and make it as inclusive as possible and try and get everybody on, but you know, not everybody cannot be on all the time but we're doing quite well this year. So far I've had no trouble in finding people week in, week out. Sometimes it becomes a real effort. I mean, sometimes it's like, how am I going to fill a podcast slot? So anyway, you know, you got in touch and we had some back and forth and so on. And you were saying, well, you know, you've just in 2019, you completed your BA in Economics and Sustainable Development from the University of Columbia in New York. And so your desire is, and your interest, it seems, and you're a Bogotano, I believe, is kind of youth-based environmental activism. Is that what you'd say?
I would say so, and not only youth-based, but rather, as I said at the beginning when I started this organization that we'll talk about for sure in the coming minutes, to tropicalize youth activism.
Tropicalize youth activism. Well, we're going to have to go into that. So what is your organization called?
So in 2019, that was late 2019, around August, September, October, along with some of the activists of the Fridays for Future movement in Colombia that was just beginning, we decided to create this group called Pacto por el Clima. Pacto por el Clima, its whole purpose is to enrich and to some extent tropicalize, as I was saying, the climate discourse around activism in Colombia, and to go and to enrich the activism space and go a little bit beyond the traditional activities of activists. We do not go to the streets, and that's on purpose. It's not because we think it's not relevant, but rather it's because there's organizations that already do that, amongst them Fridays for Future. So we want to do something else. We want to enrich the space, add new things.
Okay. And tropicalize, obviously, you know, you're pointing at the region in which we find ourselves now, not making it North American centric or European centric.
That's right. That's right. And I don't say Colombianized, even though that could be a word that we could use here, but rather tropicalized, because there's to some extent a sense of, whether explicit or implicit, a sense of camaraderie amongst youth activism in the global South. And by the global South, I not only mean a geographic region, but also a socioeconomic and ethnic region, cultural region worldwide. That's what I mean by tropicalize.
Yeah, I can see that. I can definitely see that. I can how and that how it works. And of course, you need to cast this net far and wide in order to catch the right people. So in this Pacto por el Clima, tell me a little bit about it. You know, when did it start? How many chapters do you have? Members from all over the world? Is it truly international?
No. So right now it's mostly a Colombian organization. We're about 32 members in Colombia. All of us, the majority of us would be around 22, 23 years old, with some younger, some older. And what's really beautiful about this organization is that over the past, I would say almost 2 years now, we've been able to gather a group of people that's very diverse, diverse both intellectually, but also emotionally and ethnically, gender diversity all across the group. We have, I'm the only economist in the group, and we have engineers, we have biologists, we have students of history, we have school students, and it's a really beautiful group where we've essentially try to create first an intimate space where we can learn, an intimate space where we are able to be to some extent vulnerable about what we don't know about the climate crisis. The main reason for that being that we always go out as if we already know what we're going to say, as if we already know what the solution is. And Pacto is a space for us to reflect and really dive deep into that question. Do we know what the solution is? And if we do, what is it? and then beyond that, we have a series of action lines, as we call them, líneas de acción. One of them being a pedagogical action line, where we essentially conduct different types of workshops. Most of them in Bogota. Most of our members are in Bogota, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. That's going to be very interesting. Then we also have a political action where we engage in activism politically in political spaces such as the Consejo de Bogotá, so the city council in Bogotá, where we've been supporting over the past, I would say, year and a half, the climate emergency declaration that just passed a couple months ago. We've been part of that process. We've also been part of the process of the climate emergency declaration at the national level, being invited to a lot of fora with the national government, some of them with our dearest President Duque.
Don't get me started.
And then, so the, just to quickly wrap up what we do, we also have a new action line that's called Creación, so creation. And it's doing activism through art and expression. And last year, this was a part of a very beautiful project that one of our members led on the creation of an online gallery to show art from young Latin American artists and how on deforestation and how it relates to people, mm-hmm. people and biodiversity. Mm-hmm. And finally, we have a research branch where we try to, we're not an academic institution, but we do try to bring a new, let's say, idea or discourse that is grounded on real facts, mm-hmm. Connecting issues such as, peace in Colombia and climate change, which is a connection not very often made, but one we think is extremely relevant for climate change and the climate crisis and our activism to be relevant in a country ravaged by war, where war is the norm. So how do we make the climate crisis a seemingly, not an existential crisis for those in war, something relevant? And that's all part of what we do.
It sounds to me like you guys are very organized, and very organized indeed. And I'm curious, if you say you've got a really, diverse group of people together, there are political differences as well.
I can only imagine
that there's a kind of, you could have your extremists on both sides. So.
That's true. And you know what? That's a discussion that's been commonplace amongst different youth activist groups, not only ours, but Fridays for Future and others elsewhere. Mm-hmm. But at least the our stand with respect to politics is we are, by the very fact that we're an activist organization and that we care about the climate crisis, that we think that is an existential crisis, that is in itself a political move. So we don't deny that. Mm-hmm. However, we do steer away from partisan politics. And the reason we do that is because we recognize that, at least in Colombia, and I think that that's the case for mostly every country in the world, partisan politics, to some extent, degrades the political discussion. And it's not about the issue itself, but rather who's talking about it, rather what did the person do? you know what I mean. So just to be very clear, whenever there's discussions around politics in the group, we allow them to exist. We think it's natural that they exist. And on the other hand, I also try to spice things up and even play devil's advocate sometimes, because I think a very interesting thing that as an activist one should do is be able to empathize with whoever the quote unquote enemy is, mm-hmm. and really understand what they do. Because otherwise it's impossible for you to win any fight if you don't know who you're dealing with. Mm. So it's also a kind of an intellectual but political exercise in enriching our discourse when we do have those discussions.
Well, definitely. I mean, this is, I would say, totally and incredibly important, is to have these debates, because of course, you need to have all of this weaponry at your disposal when you come to speak to politicians. And of course, as you say, here it's all personality politics, and really someone from the Liberal Party might not be so different from someone from the Conservative Party, who might not be so different from the Centro Democratico Party, which is not a central party, and the Green Party is not a green party.
No, and that reminds me, and I love this quote I always remember when discussing politics in Colombia, from García Márquez in 100 Years of Solitude, where he says something of the sorts of, the only difference between liberals and conservatives is the time they go to mass.
Yes,
and I think
true.
That's brilliant, because that's totally the case in Colombia and elsewhere as well.
Yeah, it's true. So, but I think I would admire you and that you've got this group of people together and you've got this diversity and that you're fighting for this noble cause. But we have to discuss the idea of environmental activism in Colombia, because activism, immediately you say it in Colombia, and I can see people not far from where I am sitting now in northern Chapinero, they'll be like, oh God, these are the people who go to the streets. This is the Universidad Pedagógica. This is the Nacional. These are these irate left wingers who are connected to the guerrilla groups and so on. I mean, the word activism is tainted with the stigma. So
that's right.
For you,
that's right.
I mean, you know, you're at a very prestigious university, you're in New York and so on. You are trying to change this image.
Not only to try to change the image, but rather to make those that criticize activism realize how dumb, to be honest, that argument is, and how we'll say empty it is. It's not recognizing that activism is a very diverse kind of thing, and that activism does not only exist in quote unquote the left. Activism exists in the right. We don't have to go very far to understand that activism might be as dangerous in the left as it is in the right. if we judge by the events of the past couple months. So, but to go even beyond that, it's to redefine what activism means, because at least in Colombia, I would say that a lot of people who think of the word activism or the word, political engagement think of either personality politics, or they think about echar piedra. They think about destroying the streets. Mm-hmm. And to some extent, what we try to do at Pacto por el Clima is redefine that. Mm-hmm. Our activism is not an activism based on dogmas, but rather an activism based on self-critique and understanding, and try to be rigorous in what we do. It's not easy, because that's not what normal activism, or I wouldn't say normal, but rather conventional activism does. And I understand that might be the case, but in our our view, a world with the climate crisis and a world where the climate crisis is being discussed requires a level of rigor, mm-hmm. especially if those people like us, let's say in my case, now literally in front of the microphone, we need to know our data. We need to know our shit, as they say.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, we might be dismissed as locos, as people who don't know what they're talking about. So we should be able to go in front of a minister of finance, go in front of a chief oil executive, and have a good discussion with them, and not shy away from that, and be able to win that with arguments. And that's good activism.
Well, yeah, it's an excellent point. And the thing is, if you don't come to the table, that you will just be brushed away as sort of university students.
Exactly.
With a cause, but easy to get rid of. But it sounds like you've got everything well planned and well organized. But let's talk about activism in Colombia. It was only a couple of weeks ago that a kid got death threats.
Yeah.
I don't have his name to hand, unfortunately, but death threats for I was calling for climate awareness, really. I mean, activism's a serious issue here, and we don't need to talk too much, unfortunately, about the issue of community and social leaders, people who have been pushing for the enforcement of the peace accords, largely. This is an activism, of course, and the death toll is startling, if not horrific. So, I mean, you've got involved in something that can be potentially life-threatening here in Colombia.
That's a big question, and I think it's a question a lot of people who I've worked with in youth climate activism, at least in Colombia, are not very aware of until it's to some extent too late and they're already in the movement. Because that's not the reason they join. They join because they feel something in them that pulls them. But then with people like Francisco Hueda is his name, once you're in, it's difficult to get out in the first place. And then you're exposed to all these kinds of threats. And here I want to be very clear about something, and about the let's say the composition of our group, where I say that most of us are in Bogota, and most of us are urban Colombians, and most of the killings, most of the threats that activists face are not us. are not the people who live in the cities. And that's a function of the fact that Colombia's conflict, as we all know, is a profound divide between rural and urban areas. It's like two countries in one. Mm-hmm. And we're very, very aware of that. And all the time we first recognize the privilege that we have of being urban Colombians and not being exposed to that level of violence. We are exposed to violence online, but I think that's a different kind of violence. Very, very different mm-hmm. to the kind of violence that the young climate activists in rural areas are exposed to. And to some extent, what we try to do to bridge that divide is empathy, yeah. is practice empathy, understand the differences, and not only understand, but also shut up when we don't have to talk, and let others talk and give the microphone to others. And actually, a philosophy that we're trying to promote this year, 2021, is to give the microphone to those who haven't been able to have it. Mm. And it's part of this campaign worldwide of pass the mic. Like there's a lot of people in the environmentalist movement who've had the microphone for decades now. But there's many, many more voices that should come in and enrich the voices, enrich the type of experiences they've had, and also enrich the message. Mm-hmm. So going back to your point, yes, it's a very, very tough position to be a climate activist, at least in terms of understanding the concerns on one's life. But don't get me wrong, it's not that. I think that we're in some way above climate activists in rural areas, but we do have a privilege of not being faced with those types of threats as often. And if we do, not think of them too seriously, because we know that might not be the case for us, but for them, it's definitely a reality. And that's something that we're always very, very aware of, and something that it's saddening sometimes, because what can we do, right? What can we do? Keep being an activist. Keep saying, protect their lives. Keep raising awareness this is going on, and giving them space for them to talk and to discuss why they're being killed. Because a lot of the times we do see the statistics, but we don't understand why, what it is that makes them such an attractive target, right? And then to quickly go into that, it's because they're going against economic interests. But as an economist, I don't think the issue is the fact that economic interests exist. It's the fact that these economic interests disregard the interests of others. And I think that whole conflict, and the fact that sometimes the interests of ones of a group of people have a priority over the interests of another group of people, is the issue, and is the whole issue of a lack of structural and concise governance in rural Colombia. But we talk too much about the number of killings, not so much about why they're being killed.
That's the thing. And at the end of it, it's like, oh yeah, they killed the guy who is the autor intelectual, the guy who pulled the trigger has been caught. That's, of course this person.
That's nothing,
he or she must be brought to justice, but it's who sent the order and why and what. Mm. And it never goes beyond that. It never goes beyond that initial question. It's like, oh no, we caught the killer, as if it was it was a one-off assassination killing. It's never that. There's far more to it. And you're it's very succinct and very clear on your message. I think you've been practicing a lot in your activism debates. You're very much on message. It's quite impressive. But let's talk about it then, because of course you're, heavily involved in this. And, you're trying to influence national politics through the Consejo de Bogotá and other politicians. And you said, the president and so on. But let's talk a little bit about Colombia and climate change, because, of course, Colombia, with so much within her borders, is really at the mercy of a huge catastrophic effects of climate change. Tell us a little bit. You are far more the expert than I am. I'd like to hear your experiences, your knowledge, and what you've seen around the country.
Yes, that's a very good question, Richard. I would say that one has to first understand what the actual risks of climate change are and what they entail for at least in Colombia, a population of around 50 million people. And these, I would use a taxonomy or a typology used by people in finance, actually, that I think is pretty relevant for us as activists, but also as civilians to understand, saber cómo se come el cambio climático, to understand how you can deal with this huge issue that to some extent is seen as very distant for a lot of people. It's like something they discuss in New York, something that's going on in the Arctic, something that has nothing to do with me. Mm-hmm. And here we talk about physical and transition risks. What do I mean by physical? By physical, I mean acute and chronic risks of climate change. So essentially what I'm saying is acute being the immediate consequences of climate change, such as stronger rains in certain parts of Colombia, as we've seen in the Ola Invernal every now and then. That in Colombia, given its topographical composition with a lot of mountains all over the place, this translates directly into landslides, into accumulations of water in savannas, let's say, such as Bogota. We don't have to go very far from the capital to understand what's going on, but also droughts and increases in temperature. And at least for the case of droughts, Colombia is very, very vulnerable to droughts, not only because we exist in a very delicate environment where we see in Colombia that you travel 15, 20 minutes down the road and you're in another country, you're in another universe ecosystem-wise. Mm-hmm. But that also shows the delicate balance that exists in our country's ecosystem, where any subtle change might be able to unleash a series of events. And when I talk about droughts, it now connects with our economic system, because part of Colombia is a agricultural exporter. We're a country that heavily relies on the food that we produce locally and domestically. And we're also a country, whether a lot of activists like to accept it or not, that is powered by renewable energy. Mm-hmm. 80% of Colombia's electricity, the electricity you're using right now in Bogota, more than likely comes from a hydroelectric dam. So whenever there is droughts in the country, that directly affects our capacity to produce power. Mm-hmm. And then that goes against the basic principles of energy, which is plentiful energy at a cheap cost. And we see that at least in 2015, let's say, where we have the Banco de la República issuing a lot of alerts saying that there was inflation in the country, not because of increases in the price of food or other types of products, but rather the price of energy. So we do see a direct impact into the day-to-day life of Colombians of climate change. And these, pathways of transmission of risk are not very clear to a lot of people. Mm. Then we have the, of course, flooding in coastal areas, different from the flooding in inland. Mm-hmm. Flooding in coastal areas, most resulting from hurricanes and storms. Just to be clear for those of your listeners who are not acquainted with what climate change actually means, it doesn't mean more storms. It means more severe storms. So the same number of storms, but the severity of each is going to be ever more increasing, increasingly worse. And we see that with ETA and Iota over the past couple of months, going over the Caribbean, going over San Andres, and even into Nicaragua and those countries. And those are the physical risks. And one last physical risk that is very, very interesting is related to health. Mm-hmm. Health in rural areas and health in urban areas. In urban areas, there's something called the heat island effect, where cities like Bogota, where you go past Plaza de Bolívar down south and you don't find a single tree, that creates something called the heat island effect, where concrete and the whole, let's say, built environment concentrates heat in such a way that the difference between La Sabana de Bogota out in the open and the temperature in a barrio southern part of Bogota is significant. And that might lead to heat stroke, even in cities like Bogota. Now imagine in cities like Santa Marta, like in cities like Barranquilla, where heat is already very, very high. And then we have the propagation of new disease vectors. And here's, I'm getting into a little bit of speculation because, of course, there's a need for more academic literature on this, which is a lot of areas in Colombia have had dengue for hundreds of years. Climate change will bring on new higher temperatures for higher latitudes. That essentially means that dengue, malaria, all these yellow fever, all these tropical diseases will go up the mountain. Mm-hmm. And there might be a moment in time in the coming decades where you have dengue in Bogota. Bogota is not prepared for dengue. Hospitals might be very, very developed compared to the ones in Leticia, but Leticia knows how to deal with dengue. Bogota doesn't. Mm-hmm. And to put it in very simple terms. Mm-hmm. And then the transition risks, just to be very, very concise, it's essentially climate change will occur whether we want it or not. And a lot of countries are already thinking about that. And they're taking economic policy to transition the economy away from carbon-intensive mm-hmm. economies and towards low or carbon-neutral economies. That entails changing demand for certain goods, let's say in Colombia. Colombia is a country that is heavily reliant on oil and coal exports to finance everything.
Yes.
royalties, las regalías, as they say. So there's a risk that, let's say, a country like Poland or Turkey that imports a lot of Colombia's coal shuts down their coal plants. Where will Colombia's coal go? It won't go anywhere. And not only that, where will we get our money from? That's transition risk. Where are the regalías for Cesar and Guajira going to come from, right? That's transition risk. And you can apply that to many sectors, such as the automotive, agricultural sectors, et cetera. But that's another story, longer story. Sorry if I went overboard.
I think it's phenomenal. And of course, bringing in the economic transition, that point is, people don't think about it. You know, what if they don't buy coal in Poland or Turkey from Colombia? Where are we going to be? And very interesting to think about. Not something I'd thought about either. And I was thinking about your tale and your facts on, you know, maybe dengue in Bogota. I just this week finished a book by Timothy Weingard called The Mosquito, and he charts history and how the mosquito has totally upended so many events in history. And we're even talking not only just the European discovery of Latin America, but things like the U.S. Civil War. It was known you couldn't wage war in certain periods of summer if you were the Union Army coming south because of malaria and because of dengue and because of everything else. I mean, it was actually and when you think of the deaths from the killing and the deaths from mosquito-borne illnesses, the mind boggles. The mind boggles. Mm. And even in the far reaches in World War I, which we just think of sort of trenches and in Flanders and so on. But on the far reaches out into Bulgaria, there was malaria. There were problems with mosquitoes. And so it was so fascinating when you think about that. Of course, it's terrifying too. You can imagine Bogota. Bogota is not ready for a lot of things. That's
exactly
the truth of it.
Exactly.
And that about these heat islands, very interesting indeed. I would hope not to get heat stroke in Bogota. But you know, when we're thinking of climate change, the level of air quality here is quite shocking. And so we know, I mean, I live up on the mountain and I can look out over it and you can see during the deepest days of the quarantine and isolation, we had views of the mountains and so on. You know, the light industry and the semi-light industry in Bogota was obviously shut off. You know, and so we saw a change, and you can see that. And of course, you know, my friends will say, "Oh, you know, the nature's healing itself." I said, "Yeah, but for how long? I mean, we're going to get a few months of healing." I want to, and I know you can talk forever, but I want to ask you about this peace in Colombia and its link to climate change, because I think that's a really interesting topic. I have thoughts on this too, but you are the expert again. So tell me about that.
Oof, that's a big topic, but to put it in very very, I wouldn't say simple, but very, very understandable terms, we tend to think of as conflict as generated, as caused by humans, and we tend to think of as conflict in Colombia as caused by the whims, I would say, of a very limited group of people who've taken arms, whether for the right or the left, to wreak havoc in the country. But now, what about conflict that is not directly caused by humans, but rather indirectly, although definitely proven to be caused by humans? That's essentially what the climate crisis is. And the reason why we talk about a connection between the climate crisis and the conflict in Colombia is twofold. The first being its relation with mitigation. So when we talk about the amount of emissions, greenhouse gas emissions in Colombia, I'm going to throw out a very important statistic that I think a lot of people in Colombia don't know enough about, which is the number one source of greenhouse gas emissions in Colombia is land use, is deforestation. So whenever I see a lot of politicians saying, oh, the solution of climate change in Colombia is to put up solar panels and wind turbines in La Guajira. Have you ever read the statistics of the cause of climate change in the country? And to talk about this, after the peace agreement, there was this paper, I think, published by the Ministry of Finance in Colombia, Ministerio de Hacienda, that stated that there was going to be something called the peace dividend. And the peace dividend was this opportunity for development in rural areas. Of course, that didn't happen for a lot of reasons that we're not going to get into. But a drawback is that to some extent, the peace dividend did happen. How did it happen in those areas, Pedet, where conflict was ravaging for many, many decades? Those are the hotspots of deforestation in Colombia today. So we do see almost a superposition between the hotspots of conflict and the hotspots of the climate crisis, of the cause of the climate crisis. And the main reason for that is something that we call land speculation, not so much for cattle grazing, but rather to be able to take a piece of land, a plot of land owned by no one, work on it, quote unquote, with a couple cows every couple hectares, and then in a couple years sell it at a profit, at a very, very generous profit. And what I mean is that essentially this land, it's not owned by anyone. It's land that was owned by indigenous groups many, many years ago, indigenous groups that have been displaced. And it's land that is being used either for cultivation of illicit crops, for illegal mining, but most of it, it's for what I'm calling land speculation. Then that's on the side of the causes of climate change. Then on the consequences of climate change, we see climate change and us as humans contributing to this problem as victimarios. Why? Because climate change is a humanitarian conflict. And we see that particularly and more relevantly internationally with migrants from the Triángulo Norte. So the region comprised by Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras, where we see climate change and failing crops, coffee, cocoa, and other types of crops, driving people out in the thousands out of their lands. Those are what we call in the climate activist movement, climate migrants. not legally recognized by any country in the world as refugees. Nonetheless, refugees. Refugees from which war? A silent war. A war that we can't pull, we can't signal anyone as being the sole cause of that conflict. But also a conflict that we know exists. So that's why it's important to tropicalize the climate discourse, going back to the beginning. Because if we still think that climate change is about, quote unquote, our future, the future of my generation or, and the generations after me, or we think it's about the integrity of nature in very romantic terms, we're missing the whole point, which is there's victims of climate change today. And climate change, and this is a very personal opinion of mine, is not about the environment. It's about humanity and humanity's survival. So I think that to put it in very concrete terms, that's the connection I see between conflict and climate change, specifically in Colombia, where, you know, displacement in particular has been a symptom of the lack of good governance in Colombia.
Wow. Yeah, it's there's a lot there. There's a lot there, definitely. And but then it's Colombia. When have we ever been able to explain anything in just a succinct
in
phrase?
A couple words? Yeah.
Yeah, it's Colombia. But so tell me, and we're going to have to wind this down, unfortunately, but I'm going to have you back on the show at another time because you speak so well and so knowledgeably. So we need to get you back on. But as a young man, your perspective on the future for Colombia in terms of your activism, climate change, national politics. Again, it's a huge question, but you must have an idea or an outlook for the future. I mean, mine presently, but we're sitting in what is another sort of quarantine style thing, is not so positive. But what is your generation? What are people in your position? What are they thinking?
So I'd like to bring on the words of the former secretary of something called the United Nations Framework Convention of Climate Change.
Okay.
And it's a long name, the UNFCCC, for the body that essentially convened the Paris Climate Agreement.
Mm-hmm.
And the former secretary of the UNFCCC, her name's Cristiana Figueres. She's a Costa Rican diplomat, mm-hmm. brilliant woman. Who was one of the main architects of the Paris Climate Agreement. And her words, I think, resonate with a lot of young people, whether they know the words explicitly or they can empathize with the feeling. And she always says, we need to be stubborn optimists. What I think she means by that is that if we don't think there's any way out, and if we let the numbers, and here's where climate change turns human, if we let the numbers and the science guide our thinking, then everything's lost. Mm-hmm. And sorry, the battle is always, it's already lost. Like, why fight a battle you know you're going to lose? Mm-hmm. And that's why I think that listen to the actual hope of young people. And that's where it becomes interesting, because it's not an optimism that's blind. It's an optimism that it's very well aware of the data, but also an optimism that recognizes the possibility and all the opportunities in young people. And not only in young people, but let's say in Colombia, a couple of months ago, I read in Succession, also because of you, the book by Wade Davis on the Magdalena. Yeah. And then after that, I read The Invention of Nature by Andrea Wolf, which is this very, very miraculous, I don't know, summary of Humboldt's life, Alexander von Humboldt. And after reading all that, you say, Jesus, like, why as a Colombian am I not aware of the country that we have? Mm-hmm. Like, of course, I've always been told that we're a country of riches and whatever, but wow. And it's like, this has been sitting there doing absolutely nothing for hundreds of years. Like, how am I not going to be an optimist if I'm sitting on a pile of gold and not gold that's going to be spent like traditional gold, but rather to put it in very romantic terms, like green gold that grows out of the ground gold that never will never run out if you're able to take care of it.
That's incredibly upbeat and a wonderful way in which to bring this episode to an end. And I love the idea of stubborn optimism, and that will help me. I'm going to think about that a bit, and that's going to help. I've been going through a little bit of a funk of late regarding Colombian politics, and I'm just going to move it to one side and have the stubborn optimism that things, we have to fight the battles and it has to get better. And Colombia is a country with so much, and you say not just the gold, the green gold, there is so much to harness here within the country. And I'm not discussing that in a manner of saying the extractive industries. There's just so much here. And, you know, having spent quite a long time here in this country, you thought, I have seen a lot of it. But again, there's so much more. There's so much territory and the human capital. And of course, it's a young yes. country, the generations coming through, different generations, generations such as yours.
To interrupt you one quick second is the like a new renaissance. Like our group, like I'm very fortunate of having been able to be able to say I have friends who are at Huaco. Mm-hmm. I have friends who are in Chocó. I can't imagine my parents or my grandparents saying that phrase. Mm-hmm. And it's Colombia knowing itself. And I think that very fact is going to allow us to do many, many wonderful things. Like it's like the sky is the limit. That might sound a little bit cheesy or cliche, but fine. I think it's very, very pertinent.
Please, please hold on to that optimism. Hold on to it with both hands. Don't let yourself become old and jaded like me. Listen, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for agreeing to come on, taking time out of your day. Has your Pacto por el Clima, do you have a website or a way that people can get in touch?
We do. We have a website. It's pactoporelclima.org. And the por is an X. So Pacto X el Clima. But you can also go online to our Instagram page. That's where we keep everyone up to date with what we're doing. It's @ so @ Pacto por el Clima on Instagram, on Twitter, and on Facebook. Excellent. And there you'll see everything, absolutely everything we do.
Excellent. I will put those up in due course on all of our social media and share this. Let me just take this moment to say, Juan José Guzmán, thank you so much for your time. It has been not only educating, but uplifting having you on and talking and, you know, someone of a very different generation to mine. And it's such optimism, well, there's a realism there too. You know, if you work together and you push it and you are getting your messages across to people in positions of power and, of course, positioning yourselves for positions of power in the future. This is what the younger generation has to do. You have to occupy these seats and then push through the evolution of a policy and politics. And I understand that you hope to go to grad school and study an MA in public administration and policy. Well, please do so and then come back and bring your knowledge to Colombia to help improve the situation here. That's my wish.
That's the goal. That's the goal, Richard. Thank Wonderful. You. Thank you so much for your invitation, for your time, and for your listeners. No. A generous time sharing this space with us.
Very kind of you indeed. Well, that's been episode 365. I know you've enjoyed it. It's so articulate, Juan José Guzmán, sharing his opinions and knowledge with us. And really, it's left me feeling quite good. And that leads us into other issues. And we move away from politics for a little while just to think about and reflect on what was discussed right here. So thank you again, everyone, for listening. Thank you for your continued support. Please, of course, check us out on patreon.com, Colombia Calling. For as little as $2 a month, you can help us remain financially viable. And of course, we've got our website, colombiacalling.co. We're on Instagram. No, we're not on Instagram. I'm on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, and everywhere else. But thank you once again. That's farewell from me this week.